from the Sky News Centre at 6. A judge has told a man he has a twisted view of Muslims before sentencing him to at least 43 years behind bars for the Finsbury Park terror attack. Darren Osborne drove a van into worshippers last June. The judge also praised an imam after he urged people not to hurt the 48-year-old in the aftermath. Mohammed Mahmoud says it was a natural response.
People's anger was understandable on the evening. I wouldn't go as far as to say that he would have been killed, but he would have been seriously injured had he been left to people's rage-driven attacks.
Donald Trump has approved the release of a secret Republican Party memo alleging FBI abuse of power. It concerns the investigation into claims of Russian interference in his 2016 election. The intelligence community and some Democrat politicians have lobbied Mr. Trump to stop the release, saying it could harm national security. But the president has explained his reasons for doing it.
A lot of people should be ashamed of themselves, and much worse than that. So I sent it over to Congress. They will do what they are going to do. Whatever they do is fine. It was declassified. And let's see what happens.
A father whose daughters were abused by Larry Nassar has lunged at him in court. Randell Margraves tried to attack the former US gymnastics doctor during his sentencing. 377 staff at collapsed firm Carillion will be made redundant, but the company's official receiver says 919 workers will have their jobs protected. That's the latest. I'm Kieran Kaur.
Hello and welcome along. It's the Friday Politics with me, Billy Quain, sitting in for Tony Gosling this week. In a packed show, we've got Councillor Mark Wright, Lib Dem representative for Hotwells and Harbourside, for the first hour chatting all things local. Contact us this evening. I would very much appreciate a text message on 60777. Start it with BCFM and it will come straight through to me in the studio. We're also on Twitter at BCFM Radio or studio at bcfmradio.com if you would like to send me an email. Now, quick time for weather for the week ahead. It's going to be chilly, mighty chilly, and there are occasional wintry outbreaks of sleet, snow and rain. Northeasterly breezes on Monday and weather fronts occluded from the west for the week ahead. So wrap up warm and do look in on your neighbours if you think they may be vulnerable to the cold. Right, without further ado, welcome old Labour economist Martin Summers to the studio. Martin, top of the evening to you. Happy New Year.
And to you, Billy.
You see, February and I'm still doing it. Yeah. Long time no see. How have you been?
Well, I've actually been ill last week. I wasn't on last week because I had shingles, which is it was in my eye. So it's potentially you could lose your eye, so it was potentially dangerous, and I've been on antivirals all week.
Potentially. Well done for making it to the studio this evening.
Here I am.
And we're looking forward to chewing the fat, politically speaking, internationally, and, of course, domestically with you throughout the evening. But my very special guest this evening, welcome, do please, all Mark Wright, who is the Lib Dem councillor for the Hotwells and Harbourside Ward. Mark, top of the evening. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Billy. Thank you very much for suggesting that I'm special. That's the first time in a long time that that's been suggested.
That's A-OK. You've managed to make the effort to get here through the crosstown traffic that is Bristol at rush hour, and it seems to be endless these days. We'll get on to that anon. First of all, let's talk a little about your ward. Hotwells and Harbourside is arguably the ward that has seen most rapid and most visible change and development in the last 10 years.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. There's been a lot of historic spare industrial land down there as a result of the docks essentially closing down from being an active dockyard. And those lands plots have been slowly transformed into mostly new housing, but also some new offices and some new facilities and other bits and pieces. That's been going on probably since the early 90s, but it really picked up pace in during the 2000s. And there's only a couple of plots of it left now, really. Redcliffe Wharf and what they call the old gasworks on Cannon's Marsh are the only two plots that I can think of that were originally derelict industrial land, soon to be turned into new houses. So lots of new residents down there, new communities coming together and sort of starting to form. It's a lovely little ward. It's an exciting community.
Excellent. Let's talk about the geographical boundaries of your ward. Do you get up as far as the council house?
I do, yes. So what might be of interest is that there was a boundary review in Bristol in 2016. The ward boundaries were changed quite substantially because demographic change in Bristol. There had been so much growth in the city centre that there needed to be more councillors in the city centre, basically. So the wards were redrawn. I had been the councillor for the city centre ward, which was called Cabot, since 2005. So I did 11 years as the councillor for Cabot, and Cabot covered Broadmead, the university, the city centre, Brandon Hill and Harbourside. And that got divided up into two wards, one called Central and one called Hotwells and Harbourside. And so I stood for election in the Hotwells and Harbourside section. That was in 2016. And it covers Brandon Hill and the harbour, basically up to the watershed and the Lloyd's building. And it sort of goes down that, effectively down St Augustine's Reach over to Elmshead and along Spike Island to the Cumberland Basin.
Okay, good. So essentially it's the bit that you take people who are coming to visit you for the weekend. It's the bit that you walk them around the harbour that is your ward, essentially.
I would say, of course, that it is the prettiest part of Bristol.
Yes, the tourist honeypot. But a lot of the development that's gone on there, certainly in the last 15 years, 20 years actually, is high-rise. It's one front door from multiple dwellings. It must make canvassing on the doorstep rather problematic.
It does. It's the bane of my life. I've spent more days than you can possibly imagine speaking into anonymous speakerphones where I just stand for an hour or 2 hours in front of a big block of flats, pressing buzzers, speaking into it as one person after another says, no, we don't want to hear for you, or yeah, we're voting for you, or go away. Occasionally people will invite me in, of course. But it does make building a community difficult. I've always been opposed to gated communities in principle, and I think we have tried it via the planning process to avoid properly gated communities down there on the harbour side. One or two slip through the net occasionally, but we've done a pretty good job of preventing them from being all walled off. So mostly you can walk among the new blocks of flats, but you can't get in up and into the corridors. And I do find sometimes residents write to me and they say, you know, oh, we feel a bit left out here. And I point out to them that I have literally never been in their building because I can't get in. You know, sometimes I try to get in to deliver a petition or a survey or something. It's extremely difficult. But I feel that there's a sort of a growing sense of community now that there's a growing population down there, and they're starting to have kids. They're thinking about schools, and they're getting a bit more involved with things. Historically, the new build flats tend not to be that engaged with anything local, really. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a shame. But the longer people live in these new flats, the more they get a little bit sucked into local politics, either because they're annoyed about stuff or because they're thinking about schools or health. And so there is starting to be, you know, a bit more engagement, and I think that's a really good thing.
Talking about your tenure as a councillor for Cabot originally, and now of course for Hotwells and Harbourside, if we look at the extant built environment that you are custodian of, mm-hmm. within the council chamber, what do you look at and you think, oh God, I wish they hadn't given that permission? Or do you think, with the benefit of being able to see it manifest in bricks and mortar now, or very ugly glass and steel, that's a matter of aesthetic taste, obviously.
Indeed, yeah.
Do you think the council could have done better with the redevelopment of the former industrial harbour side?
That's a perfectly fair point. I mean, I would never publicly malign the buildings that my residents have paid money to live in, because of course they will literally never vote for me, because that's that's not going to go down well if I tell them that the place that they have spent a lot of money on is absolutely terrible. But I think it's definitely true that it didn't, the Harbourside did not turn out. It didn't reach the level of the city's aspirations. Certainly, some of the earlier parts, I do feel that, and I think that's not a controversial point to make. I think most people would accept that. Some of the buildings have been great. As we've used up more and more of the Harbourside, and as we've sort of learnt some lessons along the way, I do feel that the quality of the builds has been increasing. And actually, if you go down to Wapping Wharf now, behind the M Shed, the museum, the buildings that they've just put up there, I think, are really excellent. They're very good quality build, using really good quality materials. And actually, they've got so much better at designing the public space as well. The cargo is there at the moment. You've got those trees with the lights and everything, and it's a beautiful area. But I feel, probably nearly all of the Harbourside could have been that quality, but probably isn't, and that is a shame. There are a number of reasons for that. One is, if we're honest, some of these big developers, they played a bit fast and loose. If you look at some of the original diagrams of the builds, they look a lot nicer than they actually turned out, and I'm not quite sure why that is. Perhaps there was a little bit of scrimping and saving on the materials as they were going up. Another issue which was a problem was that, of course, we had the property crash in the middle of the development of a lot of buildings. Some of the companies went essentially bankrupt and had to be bailed out by the public sector housing fund in 2008 and 9 and 10, whereby basically they had money thrown at them in order to be finished. And that's why there's a surprising amount of social housing down there on the Harbourside. People don't realise this now, because the government's housing stimulus fund in 2009 was only available to build social housing. So these companies that went bankrupt basically said, the government said, we will give you enough money to finish this building if you make it into social housing. And so there, there is quite a lot of social housing now down there on the Harbourside that was finished with that money.
One of the things that is incumbent on any large developer a lot of the time is to fulfil his section, whatever it is.
Section 106.
Thank you, 106. To provide public facilities, amenities, make contributions for schools, for local healthcare, for, the playground, recreation, this sort of thing. It appears to me very little of that has actually taken place within the context of the Harbourside redevelopment over 20 years.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. My political colleague and one of my predecessors, Councillor Anne White, her name was, she was a councillor from sometime, I think perhaps late 90s until about 2007. And she campaigned, she was a councillor for Cabot at the same time as me for just 2 years. She campaigned very strongly before I was elected for a school on the Harbourside down there. And the council's line back then, and this would have been back in 2002, 2003, different planning officers, of course, to there are at the council now. The council's line back then was, these are basically yuppie flats. There won't be any kids down here. We don't need to have schools down here. Which was stupid for more reasons than you can write on the back of an old envelope. But key among them are that when young professionals move into flats, they may well not have kids, but then they have kids, and they don't always find it easy to move. And, of course, the second issue was that when a load of these blocks were finished as social housing during the housing crash, of course, social housing nearly always has kids. That's the whole point of social housing. So now there are lots of people with kids down on the Harbourside. They bought flats, and now the housing market is so expensive they can't afford to move anywhere, so they're staying put. So, there are more people who would ordinarily have moved to a house when they had kids. They're staying. So we've got lots of kids down there. There's been huge demand for schools, and it's been a terrible problem trying to find land for schools. We had this issue of the caravan park on Spike Island, which was the council's terminated there, didn't renew their lease last year, and the original intent was to put a new school there. I think the thinking has moved on now. I think the thinking now is that there's just going to be housing there. But there is still a dire need for schools in the inner city.
Hold on a second. There's now going to be housing on the camping in caravan site on Hotwells Road, on Merchant Road, Cumberland Road.
Well, this is a part
when
of...
When actually the lower two floors of the city library, the 400-year-old city library, mm-hmm. that building isn't 400 years old, but mm-hmm. Bristol has the second oldest public lending mm-hmm. library in the world, is being put over to primary school, state primary school, and the obvious last remaining site for an actual purpose-built primary school is being given for housing. More housing.
That's my understanding of the mayor's strategic vision for the Cumberland Basin and what they're now calling it West Harbour. That is the housing on the campsite there is part of his grand vision. I understand it's been very difficult to get any information out of him.
This is your ward.
I know. In fact, and the moment that I heard after the mayor's public speech saying he had a grand vision for a new strategic housing development and knocking down the Cumberland Basin in the Cumberland Basin, I wrote to him and I said, "Dear Mr. Mayor, this is fascinating. I'm obviously very keen to get involved and to convey the views of my residents and to help you in this plan, because I think we all understand it's a good idea to build some housing down there on the Cumberland Basin. There is some scope for that." And he replied with a one-liner to me which said, "It's early days, I'll get back to you."
Is this normal communication standard from our current mayor?
I think it was a bit worse than usual, and I did take him up on it. I did have a quick chat with him a couple of weeks later, and I said I didn't really think that this was good enough. And he said that, to be fair, was probably done by an assistant, and he said he didn't feel it was a good enough reply. He would get some more information to me, but nothing else has ever arrived, unfortunately. Okay. So, I mean, it is tough to find out what the mayor's plans are.
Right. This is a story I hear quite a lot from people who try and get straight answers from the mayor, that to your face, he's genial and personable. Very little actual information seems to trickle out from him at any point, apart from great ideas like undergrounds, going to the airport. We'll come on to that anon. Well, listen, I mean, you are the elected representative for that area. You have a number of council taxpayers who I'm sure have paid over market value for a limited square footage because it's got water frontage. It doesn't appear to have very many schools. It has traffic problems and it has a residence parking zone. How are they going to channel their grievances through you going up the chain?
They're very good at getting in contact with me to air their grievances. The main problems that people raise in the city centre actually are to do with things like noise and parking. And actually, the residence parking zone is very, very popular. They're very much in favour of it, and they want to extend it as much as possible, ideally to all hours and all days, it seems.
Could I, you know, genuinely, they're already paying road tax, they're already paying VAT on their petrol. And then they get a stealth tax stuck on them as well. And now there's talk of introducing Sunday parking charges also.
Yeah, well, one of the Labour Party's manifesto promises when they were elected in 2016 was to have a review of all the RPZs, which was a good thing. I supported that. And that review in Cabot Hotwells and Harbourside happened with all the rest of them through the summer and the autumn of last year. And there was support for extending. So at the moment, the scheme is 9 to 5. Monday to Friday, and there was support for extending that a bit. So they wanted longer hours and more days. There was a bit of disagreement over exactly which longer hours and exactly which longer days. And I'm still waiting on the final reply from the council. I suggested to the council that on the basis of the public responses, I felt that 9 to 7 and Monday to Saturday was probably the sweet spot of what the local residents were requesting. There is of course a balance to be had, because if you make it residence parking all through the weekend, you do clobber the local businesses that function on the basis of a harbourside tourist business, and you know the little cafes and the other little venues that do require a little bit of off-street parking down there and around the harbour. So I think going 7 days a week would not be a good idea. But the public, you know, they do like their parking system, because without it, they cannot park anywhere. That's the problem. I think they don't mind paying 50 or 100 quid a year to be able to park somewhere, at least even somewhere.
Okay. It is slightly choking the city. And with the swing bridge going out of commission for an awfully long time, and talk of it...
Prince Street, you mean?
Yes. And talk of it going re-out of commission after Metrobus is up and running, and talk of the St. Mary Redcliffe redevelopment and the pedestrianisation there, that leaves two access points to the city from south and west, being the gyratory at Temple Meads and the Cumberland Basin coming in that way. That sounds like chaos to me.
The traffic engineers who do all this modelling, they say that they believe that the Redcliffe changes will not make things any worse. Now, I mean, we can argue about that, but I do agree. I think over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of deprioritising of sort of through traffic and in traffic, which and I wrote to the mayor and to the transport cabinet member, the previous transport cabinet member before he was fired. I wrote to them outlining the fact that I felt that closing down rat running and things like that was fine up to a point, but you reduce the sort of emergency capacity of the city in the event that one of the key routes is blocked. If you block every rat run in favour of a key route, and then that key route is blocked by a crash, there's literally no other way to get anywhere. And one of the problems we had over the last couple of years in Bristol was that any time a lorry broke down somewhere or a car crashed somewhere, the whole city would come to complete gridlock for 2 or 3 hours, you know, even until 9 o'clock at night. And to be fair, I think the mayor did see that this was a problem, and he created this transport and traffic sort of super contact group, of which I must admit I've no idea what they speak about or what they do. We're not really aware as to what they're being producing, but I think he's taking it very seriously. It would be nice to know what they're saying. But in terms of going forward, you've mentioned about closing even more routes. You know, yeah, I agree. I think that's until we have Metrobus and other things up and running and really working well, I would say it's dangerous to even consider closing any more routes through the city.
Interesting. Thank you. You're listening to BCFM. My name is Billy Quain, sitting in for Tony Gosling this week on the Friday Politics Show. Joining me in the studio, Councillor Mark Wright, Lib Dem representative for the Hotwells and Harbourside Ward, formerly of Cabot for 11 years. Looking back over your political career, Mark, how much responsibility do you feel you ought to take as being the incumbent councillor for a lot of the, how should we say, aberrations that we've just highlighted over your tenure as councillor for Cabot and for Hotwells and Harbourside?
That's a perfectly fair point. In terms of how much my fault is it because of Bristol's traffic? I mean,
about the traffic, the planning, the lack of schools, people who redeveloped the old hospital, wriggling out of their 106 responsibilities, similar to this Finsel Reach crowd who have been playing fast and loose with everything else. And then the redevelopment of what I was assured when I first moved to Bristol 23 years ago to study quantity surveying was contaminated land at the gasworks. And that has been quite literally developed up to within a millimetre of the very contaminated area.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I mean, going back to the issues you just alluded to, of course, I mean, I would make the point that I did actively oppose nearly all of the things you just mentioned. I opposed the hospital conversion to flats on the grounds that they were shirking their... It was affordable housing they got out of. They got through with zero affordable housing. I objected.
As did Finsel's Reach.
Yeah, indeed. I objected to the hospital going through with zero housing. I've always been campaigning in favour of extra school down on Harbourside, and so did my predecessor before me. What was the other issue? Sorry.
Well, I mean, you know, you're there. You're taking your stipend every month.
The buck has
to stop somewhere. You can't keep saying this was this planning officer's decision and there wasn't a sufficiently compelling planning argument not to grant permission for this.
You're dead right, of course. But I mean, you know, planning decisions are taken by a planning committee, which is generally 11 councillors, and they vote. So I turn up, you know, if I'm dead against a proposal, I'll turn up. I'll make a statement saying I think this is rubbish, and I'll turn up and I'll say I think this is rubbish. But you know, if my speech doesn't win the day and they vote in favour of it, then they tend to go through. And you've got to bear in mind with these housing issues. The other side of the coin is that Bristol so desperately needs more houses that it's always difficult to argue, you know, is it better to block this set of plans in the hope that we will get more affordable houses, but there's also a chance that we will get no houses, you know, and councillors weigh this up in their mind. So, I mean, I objected to that that hospital conversion on without affordable housing, but I think the argument that was being used by the planning officers to the councillors on that committee is if this doesn't get through, it won't get redeveloped, because redeveloping a listed building is so expensive, you know, if they're forced to provide affordable housing, they'll simply not bother, which I felt in that particular case was not true, but a majority of councillors were persuaded by that.
With hindsight, would it not have been possibly an idea? I realise that it was slightly antiquated infrastructure, but we have seen yet again the NHS with University of Bristol NHS Trust under particular pressure again this winter. There was a public infrastructure building there which was specifically for healthcare. Could one not argue that maybe the council could have picked up some of the slack with its social care and unblocking beds in specialist care at the BRI and actually maintaining some kind of hospital presence to get people halfway back out of emergency beds or from ward beds into what was redeemable from the old general hospital before moving them on to homes or getting them back into their own homes?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I don't claim to be an expert on the strategic direction of the Bristol Health Trust, but it's worth bearing in mind they've also, of course, just moved out of another major old building, the new old BRI next to the bus station, the Georgian one there. They've also just moved out of in favour of more redevelopments. I guess their feeling is not that they're short of. I don't think their feeling is that they're short of the physical space to put the beds in. They would argue they're short of the money, the running costs of those beds, you know, which is why they're having to cut back. In terms of the buildings, I think the reality of maintaining Victorian and Georgian buildings for hospitals is that they just cost so much to fix.
No, I realise that. Well, yeah. I probably didn't articulate it as clearly as I could, because there is an essential dilemma with local social care, which is provided and paid for by the council, and emergency healthcare, which is paid for and provided by the NHS. And a lot of the arguments that the NHS have every year is that patients are coming in, we're fixing them, but they have nowhere to go to because the council, there isn't the provision within local social care to move these patients out of the essential, where they need essential doctoring, where they to get them onto somewhere where they just need supervision and continued convalescence.
I see. Okay. I see. Yeah, I think I see the point that you're making. I must admit that it's not something that I've heard of in discussion around the council, that the problem there is a sort of a lack of, I don't know, big dormitory buildings, if you like, that people could be put up in after they've been in hospital. I'm unsure on that, to be perfectly honest.
It was just a shot in the dark, kind of random. We're going to pause for a bit of music, and then we'll come back and talk about slightly more practical matters that we can actually affect practical solutions for. You're listening to BCFM, and this is The House Martins.
Stand up from the highest mountain valley low. children of the world can see. This is a better place for us to be. The place in which we were born, so neglected and torn apart. Every woman, every man, join the caravan of love.
Stand up,
stand up, stand up. Everybody take a stand. Join the caravan of love.
Stand up,
stand up, stand up. I'm your brother. I'm your brother, don't you know? She's my sister. She's my sister, don't you know? We'll be living in a world of peace. In the day when everyone is free. We'll bring the young and the old. Won't you let your love flow,
From your heart? Every woman, every man, join the caravan of love.
Stand up,
stand up,
stand up.
Everybody take a stand.
Join the caravan of love.
Stand up,
stand up, stand up. I'm your brother.
We go, House Martins. Oh, that takes me back, and I've become much more zen after that. Welcome back. It's the Friday Politics with me, Billy Quain, sitting in for Tony Gosling, who's away off someplace. Martin Summers is in the studio with me. Martin, good evening.
Hello there.
And we're also joined, I'm delighted to say, by Mark Wright, who is the Labour...
Lib Dem.
Beg your pardon. Liberal Democrat ward representative at Bristol City Council for Hotwells and Harbourside. One of eight Liberal Democrats in the council these days, which represents an enormous change in fortunes. They are outnumbered by three now, compared to the Greens, who were for an awfully long time the smallest party, recognised party within Bristol City Council. So, eight members, Mark, and you're looking at somewhere in the vicinity of 37 or 47 Labour members at the moment. Do you feel you've been shouted out a little bit, and did you deserve it?
Well, I remember the good old days when we were 38, I believe, for a period 2009 to 2011. I had a lot of colleagues then. Certainly, the things were very, very different. Of course, the coalition was the unpopular thing which absolutely clobbered us from the first set of elections from 2011 onwards. During the coalition, we lost councillors heavily across the entire country. During the coalition, we lost a third of our entire councillor base, which was several thousand.
What would you put that down to?
I would put it down to the unpopularity of the coalition, quite obviously. It's perfectly fair to say that the people who voted for us and who liked us were left of central people mostly. Some of them were, I would call, ideological liberals who have stayed with us, but others of them were Labour, sort of former Labour supporters who departed over Tony Blair in the Iraq War, but who remained nevertheless left-wing voters, and others were voters who were sort of plague on all of your heads, who after they flirted with us went on to UKIP. Now we lost all of the centre-left voters that had come from Labour over the Iraq War, and we lost all of the voters who hated everyone who went to UKIP, and we only kept a sort of core of our vote, which was not enough to hold on to very many seats at all. So we got brutalised electorally during that period. In a lot of cities, we were completely wiped out. And in Bristol, it sounds bad, we went from 38 down to 8. But actually, compared to many of the northern cities, we went down from running the councils to having zero councillors. So we clung on quite well, I would like to say, in Bristol.
Can you legitimately attribute that downturn just to the National Party and the coalition MPs? Or do you feel in your soul that local politicians need to shoulder some of that burden as well, with some of the decision making that was made in Bristol and other cities during that time?
Well, I would remind you that there was a Lib Dem leader of council for most of the period from 2003 to 2010, and we gained councillors nearly every single year during that period. And we continue to lose, and so George Ferguson took over running the council in 2012, but that didn't stop us losing councillors. You know, we continued to lose councillors very heavily during that period when we weren't running the council anymore. So I think it's a strong defence of saying it was mostly national issues which was steering that, because we didn't have a problem when we'd been, you know, by 2010 we'd been running the council for most of the previous 7 years, a couple of Labour spells between, but we were still gaining seats then.
Okay, so let's look at some of the legacy of the Lib Dem leadership of the City Council and the decision making that went on at the time. The Saint Tim Kent, member for Hengrove and Withywood, Liberal Democrat, still with his seat, signed £1 million cheque to put some traffic islands on White Ladies Road. He was one of the driving engines behind steamrolling the Metro bus decision. And of course, we've got the £10 million hole next to Templemead Station, which is the arena. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on some of these broad stroke policies?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Metrobus started, I think, in the early 2000s. I would be perfectly honest, and everyone who even supported it then would be perfectly honest and say, what we really wanted was a tram system. I think everybody believes that. Everybody agrees in that.
So why didn't we go for a tram system?
We didn't get it because government policy at that point was there is no money for any mass transit system other than bus-bound and rapid bus transit. That was Labour Party policy from from pretty much 1999 all the way through until 2010. There was no money for any other system other than that.
Manchester appeared to get trams without too much difficulty at the time.
Yeah, but they got the grant secured long before. See, the grant money and the project's plans for Manchester's tram system went in the mid-90s. So they had got the money and they'd got the plan secured, but the government said for all new tram systems, there will be no new money for anything other than bus stuff. And Bristol's was a new system at that point. The old tram system, the one in the late 90s, had died a death. And so it was the government considered the plan that was coming forward to be a new one starting from scratch. And they said, it's either buses or it's nothing. Now, we were unhappy about that. Everybody was unhappy about that. But we figured, correctly still, in my opinion, buses are better than nothing. So we went with buses. Now, the coalition government changed the law and the rules in 2012. And we kept asking them, you know, can we have a tram system? Can we have a tram system? In 2012, they said, you know what? Yes, we are going to change the laws now. You're allowed to have a tram system. There is the same amount of money for a tram system as you were offered for a bus system, which, of course, means not a tram system, because you cannot build a tram system for the same amount of money as the Metro bus system.
So this is 2012. Let's go into the timeline now for a second. Nick Clegg and his cohort says, yes, we can make money available for a tram system. Ground hadn't yet been broken on Metrobus at that stage. Was there not a case to be made to say, great, we haven't dug up the grade one soil running down the side of the M32. We haven't caused enduring traffic chaos in the city for 4 years. Frustrated businesses and residents alike to the point of thinking, do you know, I think I'll just move to Cardiff. The Lib Dems were still, they had friends in Whitehall at the time. Why wasn't the decision then made either to regenerate the Henbury Loop project or to go ahead full steam on the trams?
Well, the reason...
ground hadn't been broken.
Yeah, contract, sure. Yeah, yeah,
you can back out of a contract even though you may have a little penalty with the developer or whoever it happens to be, but that's a damn sight less, I'm certain, than the £38 million overspend that we're currently facing.
Yeah. Well, we did call in our favours, and the favour that we got was that the government said you can spend the same money on a tram system instead if you want. But a tram system will cost twice as much. That's just the reality of it. And the government was not going to bridge the extra 100 or 200 million that would have cost. And the problem with tram systems, as you see, if you look at the Edinburgh tram system, which, you know, and we may well talk about the overspend and the delays in Bristol shortly, but the Edinburgh system went 100% over budget, which I think is 200 million. And it was, 1.5 years or 2 years late? Because tram systems are more difficult than bus systems. Metrobus has been difficult and it's had its issues, but tram systems are even more difficult, and they're even trickier. That's the reality of it. So the decision that the council were faced with was the government's basically saying you can foot the extra 100 million or 200 million to go for a tram system, which will be much more difficult. There was no way we could afford that. Well, so we had to go with the least worst option, which was continuing with Metrobus.
May I say, the final books haven't been published yet, but even before a single bus has gotten onto the Metrobus guided system or a single ticket has been bought on this unique ticketing system, they're already 38 million overspent that Bristol City Council, Baines and South Gloucestershire are going to have to, not Baines, North Somerset and Bristol City, South Gloucestershire are going to have to stump up for. Yeah. So that's 38 mil already. You know, even look from the outside looking in, and I don't no longer work within the building industry, you don't ever disclose the full figure until you can hide it behind the finesse of, look, but it's working, look what you got. It's going to be 400 million by the time it's finished, and 200 million of that is going to have been stumped up by local council taxpayers. So with hindsight, again, it sounds like maybe you should have gone for the decision.
No, I don't think it will be anywhere near 400 million. At the moment, you're right, there is an overspend at the moment, and that's not good. But to keep it in context, I believe that the overspend is 15%. Now, if you look at the history of major infrastructure projects, major capital projects, there is almost always an overspend, and the overspend is typically in the 10 to 30% mark, except for when it goes very badly wrong, like the Edinburgh tram system, which did go very badly wrong and is hugely overspent. If Metrobus comes in 15% overspent, I would say, first of all, obviously that's not great and it's a real shame, but actually, in the grand scheme of major infrastructure projects, if at the beginning of it people would say, you know, would you accept a 15% overspend? You'd be surprised at how many people would say that's not too bad, actually.
I hate to bring it back to basic arithmetic, Mark, and I like you very much. I mean, don't get me wrong on this. 15% of 200 million is 30 million. It's already at 238 million. So we're looking at 19% already before there's a single tram on the thing and before there's a single ticket available. By the way, what do you know about this unique 21st century ticketing system that's causing all the delays?
Yeah, I'm perplexed. I'm as perplexed as you by the fact that this ticketing system is causing so much difficulty, because in Europe, where they have, you know, tram systems and metro bus systems all over the place, they use these computerized and contactless tickets, and they don't seem to have much of a problem. And so, admittedly, it probably is the first ticketless electronic bus system in Britain, but I don't understand why they couldn't just go and ask those nice foreign people in the EU how they did it. I don't understand at all the cause of this delay.
Ask the TfL people how Oyster cards work? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. It's peculiar. It's very peculiar. And, you know, the delay that they've added on now, because I was told, as you can imagine, I mean, I'm constantly on at them, because a lot of the digging up works are in the Harbourside ward, because the route goes right through the middle of it. So I'm constantly asking him, when's the finish date? And they keep saying, since last autumn, they've been saying, it's just the ticket machines now. It's just the ticket machines. But we've had 6 months of delays for the ticket machines alone. It's insane. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Presumably, ticket machines aren't something that you need to do on site the same way that you need to build your guiding tracks on site. They could, the minute the dotted line was signed and the money was handed over, they could have started work on these machines.
Yeah, I know. It sounds very peculiar. My suspicion is they probably changed the ticketing technology at the last minute for some reason. It seems very strange.
Do you feel in your soul that the truth is being disclosed to councillors and to the electorate in Bristol about Metrobus?
I think for the most part, probably yes. I think, if anything, one of the things that the council has learned over the last few years is, don't try to keep things secret, because people will get onto you, and people will, it will all come out eventually. The thing with the ticketing is why I'm perplexed, because I don't understand what exactly it would be that they would want to hide. And it's perfectly clear from looking at the building works that nearly everything is finished. Nearly all of the hardware, the roads and the lanes and the bus stops, they are all nearly all finished. So, it's not like they accidentally finished to do a bridge or accidentally didn't finish a bridge, and that there's a bridge somewhere that still needs finishing. That's all done. As far as we can see, it really is only the ticket machines which haven't gone in, and it's a mystery as to why suddenly this requires 6 extra months.
Do you know your council colleague, the sainted Tim Kent, said to me when I said, why do we need this, Tim? He said, to get the neats from Hardcliffe and Withywood to the well-paid aerospace and science jobs in North Bristol.
That's a perfectly reasonable point. It's a perfectly reasonable point. The transport network from South Bristol, which is where I'm from, I grew up in Hardcliffe, the transport system down there has always been terrible. It's helped that they finished the South Bristol Link Road 50 years late, I believe, which does enable better access to that area from the motorway via the portway. But the inability of people to get from South Bristol to other parts of Bristol, which are relatively rich in jobs. The Northern Fringe is rich in jobs because it's a transport nexus full of motorways and airports and, well, originally an airport, not anymore, full of motorways and railway lines. There are quite a lot of jobs in North Bristol. But if you're wanting to get there, at the moment by bus, it's an hour and a half journey and it costs a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And that is a problem. Because people won't do it. People won't spend an hour and a half each way.
But there is a train that runs from Bedminster Down, for instance, and a number of other stations, relatively easily accessible from South Bristol. Take you through Templemeads and you'll get up to Fulton Abbey Wood. You can get along to a number of the other stops in the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Parkway, sure. I mean,
all of these.
Parsons Street, of course, is quite a long way from Hartcliffe and Withywood. That's the first point I'd make. But the second is, you're dead right. Rail investment in this country has been absolutely shocking over the last 40 years, since the 70s, in fact. It's just been absolutely terrible. I'm going to point the finger again, I'm afraid, at the previous Labour government, who were dead against anything to do with rail. And I mentioned about them not funding tram systems, but they also would not fund the upgrade and maintenance and improvement of railway lines, branch lines. They were okay with, I think, the upgrade of the East Coast main line, and probably the West Coast main line was started under Labour as well, because those were, grandiose projects, basically, which benefited London, if we're honest. But trying to get money for any kind of branch line projects in Bristol or elsewhere, for things like the Henbury Loop or the Severn Beach Line or any number of other things, even the Porter's Head Line, which people have wanted to reopen for decades, was just literally impossible. The civil servants said there's no money for this, and the Labour, transport ministers were not willing to overrule them. They were persuaded by the argument, as they say.
Okay, Martin, I can see you're chomping at the bit. I'll bring you in a second. Let's talk about the arena, another fantastic Lib Dem idea under your custodianship and the Group of 38. How's that going?
Well, it was going great. Until the mayor suddenly decided that he didn't think it should go next to Temple Meads. There's been all-party buy-in for the idea of an arena in Bristol for probably 2 decades. And originally, when we were running the council in the early 2000s, we wanted the arena to be at the Temple Meads site. That was the plan for a few years. Costs escalated for a bit. So then there was the idea of having an arena out at Ashton Vale. And there was the idea of perhaps working with the Bristol City Football Club, maybe, to have an arena, sort of joint arena stadium kind of thing down there. That nothing came from that. And then Mayor Ferguson made it his election promise that he would deliver an arena on Temple Meads, and fair play to him. He won that election and he pushed through the plans and managed to secure some extra funding. Incidentally, extra loan funding that had never been made available to us as the council. This was the one and only thing. We were told for a long time that if we had a mayor in Bristol, the government would give the mayor more powers than the council had. That was the whole big thing about having a mayor, that we would have more powers, more devolution, more money. In the end, the one and the only thing that the government gave Bristol as a result of us choosing to have a mayor was that they let us borrow 50 million quid to bridge the extra cost to have an arena at Temple Meads. And I say that's fine. That made it worthwhile. That made it worth doing. The Homes and Communities Agency also put some money in to help clean up the site and to build a bridge onto the site, which is now built. So it was going okay. I think costs escalated some more and there was an issue about that, and I accept that the mayor wanted to keep the costs down and he was looking to keep costs under control, and that's fair enough. But nevertheless, I think there is still the scope to build an arena on that site within the budget that's been specified, and I think he's crazy to try and move it up to Filton.
Is that including your 15% contingency? Which would put it up to somewhere around 110 mil. So that's 100 million more than what's already been spent.
I suspect that perhaps the mayor's worry was that the contingency isn't big enough. Perhaps that's exactly the problem.
Okay. And bear in mind, the 10 million that has been spent on the project so far would have funded for 25 years all of the public toilets in Bristol, which apparently need to be cut. The funding has been cut this week. £400,000 a year no longer there. So if you need to spend a penny now, you can get fined for it.
Yeah.
And if you need to spend a number two, then you're absolutely effed.
Yeah. I would point out that 10 million has not been wasted. So that money was spent on, first of all, building the bridge, which is necessary, and second, decontaminating the land because it was used as a petrol and diesel store, so it was toxic there. So that land always needed to be decontaminated before it could be used. I'm getting the impression now that the mayor's plan now is to build housing there. Now that 10 million would still need to have been spent before any housing could be built there. So that money isn't wasted. I think the problem with moving the arena away is not that it wastes that 10 million, but that moving it to Filton doesn't benefit Bristol. In fact, it could actively harm Bristol city centre. That's the problem with it.
Good. Here. Martin Summers, you've been very patient. What would you like to discuss with Mark Wright, Liberal Democrat councillor for Hotwells and Harbourside?
Well, I suppose I've over the years I've been a very, very strong supporter of proportional representation. And obviously the election of a mayor was with a transferable vote. I'm not really in favour of having mayors. And your colleague, Gary Hopkins, is not really a big fan of mayors. What's your view on mayors? I mean, do you think mayors were a good idea or a bad idea?
No, I think they were a bad idea. I think the idea of concentrating all the decisions and power into one person is a bad idea because it's a job, you know, running a big city with population nearly 500,000 is too complicated for one person to keep complete oversight of. You know, this is why we don't favour the presidential system in Britain. And I find it very perplexing that politicians who themselves oppose abolishing the prime minister and having a president nevertheless think that that exact model is the one that we should follow in cities. It makes no sense to me. I don't understand the attraction.
Well, I mean, the only attraction to me, I mean, I agree with that, is that because you've got a transferable vote, you know, if we had PR in local elections, things would be very different in elections in general.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm very much in favour of that. I mean, I quite like the way they run things in Ireland, Billy. That's, you know, I mean, it's a bit of a mess, but at the same time, it's something that there's a constant rejudging.
Yeah, Martin, you've got it all wrong, I'm afraid. All you get on the doorstep in Ireland is lies, compounded by other lies and fatter lies on the church steps. I've got a couple of things, Mark, that I would like to talk to you about. We can hit on it or we can move past it. During George Ferguson's tenure, and I think probably a little while previous to that, the idea of the Bristol Energy Company, which has been running at a sustained loss for a number of years, percolated to the surface. It was opened. Green is the future. George failed miserably in his promise to make every single council building solar panelled and more sustainable. So where do we stand with Bristol Energy at the moment?
Yeah, sure. So I've seen the reports, and the reports are that they're saying it's going to take longer to get into profit than was originally assumed. The first thing I'd say is that the energy company was always expected to make a loss in its first few years. These kinds of companies always do, because what they're doing in the first few years is they're building their customer base and they're setting up the infrastructures ready in order to go forward as a viable business. And the second thing I'd say is that I absolutely still support the principle of what they're trying to do there. And I think actually, to be fair to him, so does the mayor, because he can see how having a publicly run utility, and bearing in mind now, incidentally, of course, it's now Labour Party policy, as I understand it, to bring the utilities back into public ownership anyway. So you can see where the Labour Party is coming from in this angle. And I think that's why he's not gunning for this reason. But having a service which everybody has to have. You can't not have energy in your home. So you have to have an energy provider. It's not like a phone. You know, if you're fed up with all the phone providers, you can just say, I'm not having a phone anymore. Mm-hmm. You can't say, I'm not having energy anymore. So you have to have an energy provider. So having a public sector delivery vehicle that you know and you trust and that you know is not going to rip you off and you know is not going to try and do you over or treat you badly is a great idea. And the council has got a lot of land and owns a lot of buildings where it can take advantage of that land to put, say, wind turbines on, and it can take advantage of those buildings to put solar panels on, and it can really, by cutting out the energy middleman, it can take that profit and reuse that profit to cut the energy bills for the residents.
So what's the delay? Why aren't these solar panels going on this week? Why aren't they going up now?
Well, the delay and the fact that it's not making money, it's not turning into a profit as quickly as it could, is primarily because this rotten current government that we've got has changed the law in numerous ways to make renewable and green energy less profitable and less subsidised than it was. During the coalition years, the subsidies, and to be fair to Ed Miliband before, when he was the energy minister under Labour, there were subsidies set aside for green energy companies that helped stimulate and bring forward energy companies in the development of solar panels and wind power. And the moment the coalition ended and a pure blue blood Tory government started pulling the rug from all of these things to favour their favoured businesses, which is the nuclear industry and the carbon industry. And simply put, those things are not now as the green energy industry is a lot more difficult than it was, and that has to a certain extent hit the energy company.
Okay, we've got 30 seconds. Are you going to run poo buses on the Metro bus route if you have your way?
I would love to see that, and hydrogen buses as well. Even.
No, hydrogen is tomfoolery. If you put poo buses on, this is a valid point from a council taxpayer. Poo buses create local jobs at Avonmouth.
Yes.
They unburden some of Bristol's carbon footprint and poo footprint going into the Severn Estuary.
They do,
and it is also a vast improvement on air quality. Are you going to pose this question at the next general council meeting for me?
I can if you want. I will. I do support poo buses, but incidentally, we can also make hydrogen in the Severn Estuary from tidal power. That's also local.
That's an interesting point. Thank you very much, Mark Wright.
Thank
you. It's been a real pleasure. Time for the news, boys and girls.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.